All right, Zero Books readers and viewers, it's Pop the Left with Derek Varn and me, Douglas Lane. And Derek, this week we're going to depart from our usual trip down historical lane or memory lane.
Although we haven't really done that in a couple months, to be honest. But
yeah, I guess that's true. I've been in a fog for the last couple months anyway, so I barely noticed what we've done. But yeah, so now we're going to be talking about a contemporary left publication, right publication, called The Bellows. And we selected two essays to discuss from The Bellows. One is called The Moral Austerity Trap, and the other is called Against the Managers.
Right. And heads up for the Parrot Room. We're going to go into the history of The Bellows and some of the controversies around why it may have seemingly shifted in its editorial focus in the last 6 months, but that's for the Parent Room because it's controversial.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to save the ad hominem attacks and guilt by association for the Parent Room. And for the most part, discuss the essays in front of us. But
we'll
also
start with the simplest one first, if you would.
Which
mind.
Would be the
moral austerity trap. Yeah. But yeah, you were saying, Doug?
I was going to say we might also discuss the question of a red-brown alliance or or what to do with the possibility or how to react to the possibility that some of the left publications out there are actually Trojan horses or are being infiltrated by the right. This is not something that I would say is conclusively the case with The Bellows. But I would say, that the issue comes up.
I would not say that I wouldn't say you have conclusive the case with anything, but I think The Bellows does illustrate that there is a spectrum of social democracy, which is at least convenial to a spectrum of right wing populist thought, and is somewhat aware of it. But it is not off of the same spectrum, which contain Michael Brooks and Bhaskar Sankara, as much as people might not like that. And again, we'll have to talk more about that in the Parrot Room. But I think what's interesting is if you see, for example, a lot of the Class Unity Caucus and the DSAs talk about PMC, what we're going to talk about today is only a two steps removed from that. But it also takes the lid off the origins of a lot of where this thought comes from. But let's talk about Jeff Schoenberger's The Moral Austerity Trap first, because I think this one's both slighter and perhaps less objectionable, but also less substantive than.
I feel like my job in this conversation is going to be to defend all these reactionary perspectives. That's like that'll be what I end up doing.
I think that's what people both see you doing, but also you frankly helped create this. So
I did.
Yes, you personally did.
Okay, well, why don't you save that for the Parrot Room, maybe?
I will.
but I am curious as to why you say that. But by that, I mean, look, there's a lot of what's in The Moral Austerity Trap, which you could also find versions of in the Frankfurt School philosophers and the Situationists.
Well, I wanted to talk about this one because I think I think you and a bunch of people who may or may, I mean, and I want you to talk about the three trend, though, to every person you just mentioned there. And I say this as a defender of all three of those first things. Did they stay Marxist?
I think with the board, it's debatable.
I mean, well, he was definitely ranting about positively about Red Brown stuff toward the end of his life.
Yeah, well, The Comments of the Society of the Spectacle is a very interesting book. in so much as that it's difficult to interpret, and it's been interpreted various ways. I don't recall him in that book ranting about Red Brown stuff, but I do think that there was an infection. I'll say this. Reading the comments, recently reading the comments of the Society of the Spectacle again, and then reading interpretations of it, I found that a French bookstore owner, radical bookstore owner, who had become a Holocaust denier, but never without leaving the left in his own mind, pointed to comments on the Society of the Spectacle as being a reaction to the Faurisson affair. So what I'll say about that is, I don't know if that's a correct interpretation of the comments of the Society of the Spectacle or not, but I could certainly see why he thought that it was, you know, when he pieced it, when he made his argument.
That
gets connected to Bordiga.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was about to say, you can't get out of the Bordigist and Kamet's defense of Jacques Kamet's defense of Holocaust deniers, which, you know, there is a way in which the ultra left takes a position against anti-fascism that is really easy to misconstrue as a position that becomes friendly to fascism.
Right. I mean, and we should talk about the Bordiga essay on a future episode, maybe just but I don't think the Bordiga essay is in any way actually a Holocaust.
No. I don't think that either. What Bordiga was dealing with there was a kind of what I actually know the context for that essay, and Bordiga didn't write it. And the person who wrote it was actually Jewish. So, you know, there's that. And two, I think it was more of a, there, you know, capital had to go in, you know, this way. It was an inevitabilist position, a position that I don't think is actually all that defensible, but one that I understand.
Yeah, there's a logic to it, and I don't think it's entirely wrong, but I do think it's, there's something fundamentally wrong with it. But we'd have to, I think we should just dedicate an entire episode to
that. Yeah, I mean, but anyway, moral austerity trap.
But saying the words, just saying the words Holocaust denial, as we've done a couple of times now, I feel like, you know, we're putting our channel at risk just by, because the algorithm, you know, the algorithm is dumb.
The dumb algorithm gods.
But back to this, so you asked me, were they all Marxist? I think some of the Frankfurt School could arguably be said to remain Marxist, even if they weren't, even if their Marxism didn't align with my interpretation of Marxist critique of political economy as much as I would like it to. I think Habermas and the overall tendency of the Frankfurt School ended up in a liberal bourgeois position and having left the Marxism behind, but I don't know if all of the Frankfurt School should be.
When you read Martin Jay's Dialectical Imagination, it is pretty clear that if they are Marxist, they are Marxist against Marx, because, you know, Adorno's comments that Marx wants everyone to live in a labor camp, and this, like, by the time you get to the early 60s.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's certainly. I'm just thinking of Catrone and how much he hates Martin Jay. I don't feel actually qualified to weigh in on who's got the proper interpretation of Adorno there or what the context was for that comment. But certainly there was an anti-working class streak in the Frankfurt School early on that just intensified, meaning not like they're against workers, but they no longer had confidence in the working class as a revolutionary subject.
That's true from 32 on. I mean, like,
yeah. And then Christopher Lash, I guess, gave up on Marxism over time. And just listening to your recent podcast, whether or not he remained committed to socialism is an open question that the two authors for your book, Sloan and you, debate.
Yeah, we're not totally sure, actually. And I'm personally not totally sure. I'm also not sure how much Lash saw himself as deviating from Marx, but he has a lot less patience for it by the 1980s, for sure.
For other Marxists, or
for Marxism? Other Marxists, and seemingly he just doesn't ever talk about Marx directly, except in a very few instances, and that gets less and less as you read, like after the 70s.
Let's return to the moral austerity trap, which is what we're supposed to be talking about. So what would you say that the primary argument is in this essay?
I think the primary argument is that the reduction of all costs to bare lives has two functions, one of which is to make any moral or deliberatory opposition to it automatically immoral, because when you're talking about life, it's sacred, and two, it also reduces any demands, because all you have to do is protect life. So you move from a advocacy position to a conservative defensive position. I think Schellenberger's actually right about that. As a rhetorical move, that's what it does. Like, now, there are some specifics that I thought were interesting in the article that we could talk about, because he says this is, only part of the Democratic coalition. I'll read it exactly. Nevertheless, one thing has remained consistent through the various slogans that have galvanized the constituency, the advocacy of lives. This word through a line that connects the rhetoric of several otherwise tenuously linked causes. Most obvious instance is Black Lives Matter, which emerged in the final years of the Obama administration, but was sidelined for much of the Trump era until its resurgence around the middle of 2020, which I actually call out as an overstatement. It didn't ever completely go away, nor is it completely sidelined. It was largely professionalized, is what happened, more than anything
else. It went away from the major media narrative.
Did it, though?
Yeah, after Trump, I think it did. I think it got taken up by other, especially in left media. But I think, the Black Lives Matter was no longer the major focus of the left, and it was no longer the major story. Trump became the major story, and the resistance became the major.
Of which Black Lives Matter was a part. And during the beginning of the Trump administration, they were getting tours to talk to public schools. It's hardly being sidelined. That's being professionalized. Well, just because your chattering classes don't talk about it.
Well, I just said the media, right? I said it was no longer being focused on in the media. And you said, was it not? And I said, no, it wasn't. And if you want to tell me that they were covering the tours in the schools extensively, then I will stand corrected. But there were certainly a lot of people who were in Black Lives Matter who continued to work, especially in the nonprofit sector, as after Trump was elected. But I'm just saying it became sidelined in the public conversation or in the chatter amongst the chattering classes or in the media.
Well, okay, but that's not what was claimed. It says the most obvious interest, which emerged in the final years of the Obama administration, was sidelined for most of the Trump administration. There's nothing stating what sidelined it.
Right. Well, one thing that I think we could critique the Bellows for in general is that they are focused very much on the online left. They approach the left as the online left, and they talk about politics from the perspective of people who are extremely online, and make that sort of stand in for the left overall. So this is very much kind of a product of social media, this approach. And I'm not saying that as a defense.
But let's get back to this, because I think the actual major rhetorical concern of this, let me say his name right, Schellberger's right. I mean, his outsider theory stuff aside, he talks about how this is an appeal to basic human dignity, but in so doing, actually also is a, he pulls up Foucauldian language and talks about, and Agamben language about, biopolitics and bare life, which is interesting because, you know, when the protection of biological bare life becomes the driving concern of politics, people inevitably come to see their fellow citizens as primarily vectors of danger and contagion. And we have seen that talk. And I would say that's another thing that I think is interesting about the Bellows is the Bellows is overly focused on the online left in specific. But this talk about contagion and vectors of danger has been part of American political discourse since the 60s and has been amping up since the late 90s. Like, we have seen it rise with the entirety of the internet. And if you think it's just a left-wing problem, go listen to Alex Jones. Like, it's clearly not. And
right. But right now that has a whole different connotation during the COVID crisis. You know, it's like literally people are, you know, vectors of infection.
Well, I mean, you have an issue right now where reality and rhetoric get really muddled in the sense that, and I think you're going to actually probably attack this part of it a little bit more than I am, but you seem slightly annoyed that he lumps in the COVID stuff into this.
I think that there's something to the argument that the way we're handling the COVID crisis ignores larger political and cultural even values. And that the conversation should be more open than it is around how to handle the COVID crisis. I definitely think that is the case, especially in the context of society which has had civil liberties eroded for at the very least the last 20 years and which we are being asked to subject ourselves to a surveillance state in multiple forms all the time. It's not wrong to be concerned about how COVID is going to be used to solidify the power of the surveillance state. But what I would say is that there's also just a contradiction built into any liberatory project where survival has to be a part of what you're fighting for. Like, you know, like I believe in some sort of, I don't know if I would embrace Maslow in his entirety, but I just believe it makes a certain kind of logical sense to think people have a hierarchy of needs. And if you don't have that bottom level survival one, lockdown, the other ones that the other values aren't going to be completely unapproachable. So in the case of the COVID crisis, it seems like if we have it's a real crisis on a lot of different levels, including politically and culturally, and to ignore the reality of the biological reality of COVID and the real threat it has on our survival, on people's survival, is no more justifiable than to focus to reduce everything down to mere survival.
Right. Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, specifically because it's invoked here positively, but where Agamben sounds like a crank. Agamben controversially argued at the beginning of the lockdowns in the spring that COVID-19 had become a basis for a new techno-medical despotism. And in some ways, Agamben's not wrong, but if you don't deal with the fact that as a response to an unknown disease, there's almost no way in which a crisis won't be used for some sort of despotism. And that's something that you both have to be aware of, but if you use it to advocate for doing nothing in response to the crisis, what is the point? What do you think is the fear of the despotism so great that we can't even advocate for additional actions? I think one thing though that we do have to look at is the way that like protection of life has been used selectively for a certain strata of professionals and workers to have a lot more protections than people who are essential workers and who frankly have lost out in this entire ordeal. And I'm using my words very carefully so the algorithm will leave us alone.
Right.
And I think it's pretty clear that between the destruction of a lot of wealth and QE being captured, whether or not you think that's a massive shift of income up, or whether or not you just think it's wealth capture, which I tend to take the latter. I don't think anyone's taking a lot of money from the working class and giving it to the rich. I think the rich is just being given straight up a liquid assets. But liquid assets that can't go anywhere, because the theory behind QE as a stimulus manager is that the trading that it increases would increase economic activity. And during COVID, if you increase economic activity significantly, you actually depress economic activity because it spreads the virus, and the virus itself, regardless of lockdowns and anything else, starts to cut back on economic activity as people get sick and afraid, which is why, when you look at Sweden and Japan, they have done better than the U.S. and U.S. even definitely better than a lot of the European states at economic recovery. But the only place on earth that's had a V-shaped recovery has been China, not Sweden. And I don't say this as an advocate of China. It's just an objective fact. Mm-hmm. So, like, the idea that without this we would be economically fine is nutty. People will actually respond to the virus and cut down economic activity.
But see, I'm not sure that this piece really. It doesn't. Some of the claims that it might lead people to make aren't stated explicitly by the essay, right?
No, it's stated in what the essay cites.
Right.
And this is something that I've like been telling you to look out for, and particularly in some of these essays, because what it cites, this one's explicit, but when we get to Swayuna, it's the citations are not explicit, but I know what they are. And so you have to decompress this. I mean, all of these stuff has both French critical theory in this one, but they both have James Burnham's managerial elite at the core of both of them. And they do this trick where you go from talking about overeducated professionals to talking about professional managerial class to talking about it all as the managerial class. And then what that implies. And when you know the whole Burnham theory behind that and what Burnham was on about, and we could talk about the merits of that argument, because there actually are merits to it, you realize that it is not a Marxist argument anymore, no matter what these people claim. And also we have to evaluate it on the merits and not whether or not it's Marxist. And I think on the merits, the Schulberg piece to me kind of stands up as like vague, but mostly true, whereas the Swayuna piece strikes me as much more pernicious in the way it conflates things.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel as though the moral austerity trap is making a very minor point in the style of an opinion columnist, you know, writing journalism basically to react to the moment. And so while there are things to critique about this, and the main thing that I would critique is just that what I already said, which is that while it's true that reducing our politics down to the level of protecting life can have unintended or intended consequences, which are in a contradiction to any kind of liberatory project, the truth is that you cannot simply, in the context of, like, say, COVID-19, you can't simply ignore the need for a society to protect its citizens to some degree and to be concerned about human life as a kind of ground floor for what a society is supposed to be doing. So there's a contradiction there. It's not, and the coping with COVID. It's just not going to be easy. It wouldn't be easy. It's not easy for any power right now. And it does seem to be exacerbating the worst trends that were already in play. And so I don't disagree with any of that, but I do think that overall, what I would criticize this piece for is not having the perspective of an advocate for, say, socialism or liberatory politics, but rather just having the position of a critic of the left and of, well, and liberal society. But that's okay. You don't have to have the same perspective as I do. But if you're claiming to be of the left, it would be worth it's, you know, I think it's fair for people to criticize you for not contributing very much for towards trying towards at least enriching the understanding beyond.
What's the primary class structure? So one of the things I've gotten about the post post-left as expressed in the Bellows, and there's, as we talked about last week on the Parrot Room, there's about 80 different things currently being called post-left, but the branding is very clearly tied to Michael Lind, to who also worked with Tablet Magazine and clearly has worked with the Bellows extensively. Now, Michael Lind has no historical relationship to Marxism. He wrote an excellent, I think, book on, like, reporting wise on the development of an overclass, which I don't agree with his class categorizations at all, but I do agree with his descriptions of what was going on with a kind of petty bourgeois elite developing in these poor areas in the country, a professional strata of workers and management, and actually a bunch of things that are more dependent on state subsidies and finance in hub cities, or if you want to use like Marxist terms, in the core as opposed to the periphery. And you have a tension with the hot bourgeois and the government basically picking sides on who wins on any given issue, largely with the GOP representing Sunbelt industries and those petite bourgeois. And as the Sunbelt industries themselves are becoming less and less profitable, they're more and more petite bourgeois, and they're distancing themselves from the GOP. One thing I'll say when we get to the Sway Unit article, because there's all kinds of, he makes generalizations about what Trump did that frankly Trump didn't do. They were already 20, 30 year trends in the GOP that you could go back to Christopher Lash talking about in 1984.
Yeah, that was something I noticed, not so much in terms of his analysis of the GOP, but in terms of his analysis of the left, is that the things that he was saying were endemic to today's left and would point to people like Nathan Robinson as examples for, has been a long-term trend on the left. It's not.
Yeah, when we get to the Sway Unit, there's a weird mixture of like, this stuff is all new and happened after Bernie failed, which Sway Unit's claim to fame in English before people realized his Swedish politics, which we'll talk more about in the Parrot Room, but people should know he is tied to the conservative think tank, and it is a conservative think tank, Oikos, which is tied to several members of this of the Sweden Democrats, which is a Front National party. It was even blacklisted by the Christian Democrats, which is the right wing party of the center right party of Sweden, until they hit about 19% of the vote, and the Christian Democrats had to deal with them. They went through a defascification period, but that is like Sway Unit is not in the Sweden Democrats, but he's in a think tank that consists mostly of them, and that has to be considered. The fact that you can get a lot of these people to talk more readily to conservatives than to other leftists or to themselves, because when I went looking for a lot of the outside of actually Jeff Schauberger here, when I went looking for a lot of the Bellows as writers, I can't find them except on a few articles on In These Times or Jacobin. If they were tied to the Bellows pre June of 2020, and maybe a few articles.
Well, let's save this for the Parrot Room, all this stuff. But let's go into the Malcolm Chiyun piece. Is that how you say his name? I've forgotten.
I think the KY ends up being a swa, because you looked it up. Actually, I'm going to give you credit for that.
Yeah. And then I forgot.
And it's Sayuna.
So the Malcolm, what was it called? Against the Managers. Well, if I had a primary critique of this, it would be its class analysis.
Well, since it claims to be a major form of class analysis, that's a pretty damning critique. You want to get into that?
Well, yeah. It's complicated. Like, I don't think he's wrong to say that a lot of the left is, let's say, petite bourgeois or middle class.
They're not petite bourgeois. Like, you're petite bourgeois, but most of the left does not own its own means of production. They are something else.
Well, technically, I don't own mine either, right?
No, you're
I'm a contract worker. I'm part of the gig economy. But
right. But this is all conflated in the way they break up class.
Right. But I'm not even that concerned about that. The petite bourgeois versus middle class distinction. Okay. That's important. But the primary problem I have is the way in which the working class is utilized in this piece, even though it isn't really a subject of the piece. Like, there's no working class politics for it referred to in this piece at all, but it's in the background as if it existed. Go ahead.
Well, that's been my commentary about the whole time. The working class invocation here is solely brought up as a means of justifying nationalism, and sometimes even deliberately conflating petite bourgeois and working class on purpose, which that is normally a right wing trope, and people can get mad at me about it, but it is. Mm-hmm. The bigger issue with this is that you're right that they're talking about a class war, but they see this as a class war between elites in which the working class is just being screwed. And I would even say they're probably right about that, even though part of that elite technically actually would be what Marxists would consider the upper end of the working class, the labor aristocratic working class, mm-hmm. which is like some of the P in the PMC. But there's big jumps in what Swayuna says. I mean, he starts off with the black smoke metaphor from China. Don't give a shit about that. It's a nice literary metaphor, but it's romantic thing. But then we'll get into this. This is not to say the left has lost. Only the romantic neuroticism of the 20th century left has truly died. When were we ever neurotics? Like, when were we populist? The populist left is basically something that has existed in America for all of, 4 years? And its ties to Marxism is tangential at best and mostly fucking branding.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the current populism is that. I think you could say that the historical populist movement in America had some crossover with the socialist movement at that time. But whether it was Marxist, it wasn't Marxist. And
it wasn't Marxist, and the crossover was limited to the 1910s.
Right.
We haven't had popular. Remember when Christopher Lasher writes pretty positively about early populists? He talks mm-hmm. about when Michael Harrington, in specific, mm-hmm. tried to resurrect it in the late 60s as a left wing tactic when the Trotskyist Shachtman versus the other Trot debates happened in the dying remnants of the Socialist Party of America. Shachtman tried to build a populist, I mean, not Shachtman,
Harrington.
Harrington tried to build a populist left coalition around McGovernism, and Lash called him out on it and said it wouldn't work because it appeals to everybody and nothing, doesn't actually have an actionable program, and wasn't really about what it said it was about, which is very similar, frankly, to what we saw with the Harrington Heights with Bernie. And I got yelled at for calling it out. And a lot of the people adjacent to this were also in that pro-Bernie coalition. And it does, frankly,
I think people would say we were in that pro-Bernie coalition,
too. I was fucking not. You guys would yell at me because I would only say, like, okay, if Bernie won, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But, like, the quiet parts were, like, we think even if he wins, he'll get screwed by the Democrats so bad that it'll discredit this means.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Well, I agreed with that. But somehow, nonetheless, I played ball with a lot of people who were part of, and still do, with a lot of the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. But the point is that the main point that I think you were kind of raising is that the people that Malcolm is critiquing here, the left that he's attacking, includes that populist left. Yeah. It's not the separate left.
It really never was. Like, this idea that there's a big shift in Bernie between 2016 and 2020, the only big shift in Bernie I seen is how willing he was to play with the Democrats. But I'm sorry, people, Murray Bookchin called that shit out in the 80s. So,
tell me what Murray Bookchin said in the
Murray end. Bookchin said ultimately that Bernie would have to make concessions to the Democrats and would end up being a Democratic operative because he wouldn't have a choice, and that all of his populist appeal, you know, and he did build a left coalition in Vermont basically by opposing Democrats as much as Republicans. Mm-hmm. But that his coalition would lose steam because of the nature of the government it was trying to run. He said some other things too. But, like, when I read that, and it's from the 80s, it's like, yeah, of course, the entire campaign was going to go that way, even in 2016. And in 2016, I was one of the few people who shrugged at it. Mm-hmm. I was like,
I did too, but we can go into we can go over and over this thing with the Sanders movement, but the main point here is that in Malcolm's piece, that he acts as though there was an alternative to the left that he describes as embracing moral categories rather than class politics.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm thinking, like, did he?
But read that is not separate from the Sanders.
Yeah.
Left. And
99% versus the 1% is a moral argument, not a class argument. Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's not different from the kind of left that most of the people in the bellows when they're acting for the left are part of. But the other thing I'd say is that by pointing to this completely phony moment of abandoning the working class, because this is not a moment where the working class is being abandoned by the left. This is a continuation of a long search for the left's own identity after the working
class. The left no longer the working class in the 1950s.
Well, yeah, I mean, the left has been struggling to represent the working class only to some success sporadically from its inception.
Okay, quit talking about the reified left. What left has tried to represent the working class in total or sectionally since the 1950s? The New Deal, which I also think was a poison pill. I'm not one of these neo-New Dealers that have popped up recently, mm-hmm. which I actually consider part of the right wing of social democracy. And mm-hmm. so when I talk about the right wing of social democracy, I'm not even talking about red brown stuff. I'm talking about the fact it is a limited horizon from the standpoint of what was traditionally a Marxist standpoint, which is a transition to the total abolition of value. Like, that is, in fact, you know, that wasn't even reformism as a reformism away from capital. That was a reformism to save capitalism from the worst excesses of the early 20th century form of capitalism that we had. And I mean, this is something that, again, like I've been saying, Christopher Lash said it in the 60s, this is not new. Swayuna's argument seems to project the left that, frankly, I've never known to exist in my lifetime, or yours, or even my parents' lifetime.
Well, what about, look, what about, I will say this, like, if you read about the German, I've been reading a little bit about the German Revolution in 1918, and you read about how the Social Democratic Party and the Spart split, and mm-hmm. the two versions of the uprising, and how it was basically spontaneous working class uprisings in both cases that the Social Democrats and then the Sparts were kind of tailing. What you discover is that the Social Democrats became aligned with capital's interest. And to put it bluntly, and the Sparts had no real program for power. And I would say that
was true in the, like, in the developed world, in every country. That's true of labor in the UK. That's true of the socialists in France. I mean, I was just reading Baudrillard's write-up about when, you know, as he became disillusioned with socialism, but when he's talking about what happened with the communists forming coalitions with the socialists after the Gaullism in the 70s and early 80s, like, it, you understand why so many of those French thinkers became so, you know, almost anti-Marxist, because they were burnt by people who were selling them a form of Marxism that ended up buoying up, you know, Fordism and even as it transitioned, neoliberalism.
Right. But, and those are the Social Democrats. But the thing is, there also is this other tendency that tries to represent the workers through, you know, kind of cheerleading of spontaneous uprisings and through the development of theory. I would just say, like, the sectarian Marxist left is always attempting to help what are spontaneous moments of resistance
from
the workers. And so that continued after the 50s. That continued in the 70s and 80s and 90s. That continues today.
It still happens now, but it is brief and fragmented. I want to respond to a person who says I should make a distinction between the European left and the American left. And I guess I mean the European left, because if we get into periphery, we're not talking about former working class people. I think they have a point. However, this trend that we see in America has happened everywhere. This is one thing Swayuna is actually good on, even though he often pretends the way, in this essay in particular, he pretends that somehow America works like Sweden does, paying journalists and stuff as agents of the state, which is funny. But there is a real sense in which this tendency in America has happened everywhere else after the 80s. And it has to do, frankly, I think, with the fact that the labor left had no way to deal with declining profit margins in the 70s, even if it was caused by an exogenous shock like the oil scare. They didn't have a way to deal with it. They started neoliberalizing to return profitabilities back, to get a tax base, to thus, you know, in their minds, to get a tax base back, to thus rebuild their social welfare program. But it didn't. The process in which they engaged in ended up completely dismantling, or partially dismantling in the case of continental Europe, almost completely with the exception of the NHS and some council housing in the case of Thatcherite England, the welfare state. And the United States never had that developed of a welfare state to begin with to dismantle. Like, the New Deal, when you actually study it, was public-private piecemeal, basically with the government kind of acting as a hire of last resort, but they highly encourage private investment. And then the Great Society, which we somehow run together with the New Deal in our thick heads, because time periods don't mean anything to people, is when a lot of the things that we think happened in the New Deal were actually attempted, but it happened in the context of the Vietnam War. So, you know, but that tendency happened elsewhere, and the way the left has generally responded to it is the Naomi Klein way, which is basically a conspiracy theory, which I may add this PMC stuff, when it is not being properly structural, is little better than. And I, you know, like, I'm going to go into why I think that in this specific article, because I really read this. For people who don't know, I come from the right. I'm like the opposite end of what we're talking about. And so I know the right-wing theorists that are being obliquely referenced here, as well as the, you know, some kind of more neutral politically theorists such as Peter Turchin, who are being referenced without the reference being stated.
Well, I knew you were going to go to town on this guy, but I want to ask you, what do you think of this? My overview here of the piece is that the problem with Malcolm's piece is that paradoxically is that it's only a partial critique of the left.
Yeah, well, I think
that if he had gone deeper, if he had asked deeper questions about why the left is having trouble, rather than just put it down to basically the petty bourgeois or managerial people acting in their own interests, which are not at all aligned at all, or, you know, like the people who rely on state funding don't have the same interests as the petty bourgeois.
Well, yeah, but to be fair, I think it's clear that Suyana knows that. I mean, because Michael Lynn makes a big deal of that, and Michael Lynn's not a Marxist. Hey, we got a super chat, by the way.
Oh, that's great.
We should respond to it.
Okay. We will in just a moment. I've got it saved here. But yeah, the main thing I want to say is, like, if he had bothered to critique the left more thoroughly, a lot of the background assumptions that he's making in order to morally condemn, in a roundabout way, the failures of the current left, would disappear.
And yeah, and it wouldn't be shown as new. Like, I just don't know what left he thinks existed. Like, and yeah. I know this is a weird critique of Suyana, but, like, I'm also like, when were we ever this way that he thinks? We were never Sweden. And also, I don't think Sweden has been Sweden since the 70s.
Right.
I mean, like, so, like what's he talking about here? And it seems to me that, like, you were presenting a romantic left that the real issue in this piece is an issue between an overproduced elite and a petite bourgeois who are threatened by it because of their tax base. And that's what he thinks a class war really is. Now, that thesis is in Michael Lind. Like, when I said, I think Michael Lind's work on this is actually quite good. If you like, oh, we got another one.
Well, let's look at Eliot's now first. How should the Marxist left relate to consumerism, which is the neoliberal bread and butter, increasing demand, currency inflation, vague wage appeals?
We shouldn't at all. I mean, like, I think condemning consumerism is super moralistic, but I also think, like, encouraging it is it undisciplines. I'm going to talk about, like, subject formation for a second. It undisciplines the left as individuals. It has us play into increasing boom-bust cycles, but I don't think we should be embracing austerity like imposed on ourselves as opposed to the outside.
Yeah, here's another one. Do you think religion is a possible focal point for the rural-urban divide? Do there need to be more socialists in churches?
No. yes, it is a possible focal point for the rural-urban divide. No, trying the religious socialism route doesn't tend to work because the values which you talk about as a religious socialist are going to be read by the religious people as liberal. And, you know, I don't think the secularization of America actually is necessarily a great thing as far as, like, I think it's just a neutral thing that is happening. But we are in a more secular world, even when it comes to the religious, because, like, religious literacy is, even amongst the self-identifying religious, is real low right now. I got another one.
Sockdems only ever focus on the mode of distribution, not the production side.
That's
just a comment.
That's true.
So do, you know, neoliberals.
Pretty much everybody. I just want to get into some of the points where I think Suyana's right, but then he undermines it. So, like, the very concepts of victory and defeat today are abstract and nebulous. In the UK, the Tories crushed Labour's red wall in a stunning win that probably outpaced even the most optimistic scenarios of the party's own strategic planners. Yeah, I we'll get into his actual politics with the Sweden Democrats and all that later. I think he's right that a lot of our victories, a lot of our victories have been anemic. Even this anarcho-Bidenist moment that we currently are in, where I'm seeing like people who have opposed the center for the Democratic center for years, all of a sudden talking about how, you know, we might get 5 for 15 slow road out over a year in a bill that probably will not pass without significant, not even because of opposition from Republicans, but because the two moderate Democrats are going to want to water it down. Like I'm hearing people saying these praises as if they don't know better. And that's confusing me. I admit, and it does make Soyuna's fear that a lot of the left, you know, a lot of the left, when you scratch them, what is it our monotreme friends say? If you scratch a lot of the left, you actually find a Democrat.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that's true. Anarcho-Bidenism is me being an asshole.
But it's also true, though. So someone says, you guys should expand on what you mean by moralistic, mainly because I swear 90% of all leftists can only view leftism in purely moral terms. Well, can I give a crack at this?
You go ahead.
So, you know, the like my example would be Nathan Robinson, which is the same example that Malcolm gives here. The moralistic approach to politics is one in which you are trying to embrace certain moral values to inform your positions, regardless of the conditions in which those values arise, and regardless of whether or not those values are going to be contradicted by those conditions. So a Marxist analysis doesn't stay at the level of morality because it understands that the kinds of values we have, say like equality, are born out of conditions which contradict and set up the opposition between different moral values. So, you know, you have equality, but you also have the private property as the foundation of equality, which sets up an inequality. So I wouldn't embrace moralism because moralism is a way to not get to the foundation or not be radical in one's politics. For me, the perfect example of this is when Nathan Robinson is trying to critique Angela Nagel on immigration. He says, well, you know, we want to keep immigration open and give people the chance to look for a new, better life. But at the same time, of course, we would support policies for economic democracy. Well, that's just a moral kind of claim that's pretty empty because what Nathan Robinson happens to support on paper or, you know, articulate out loud, it's his expression of that support does not mean that economic democracy and open borders under capitalist conditions can ever be achieved. And so moralism is a way to kind of pay lip service to certain values as if simply holding certain subjective values is enough to enact major changes in the world. That's my idea.
I would agree with that analysis, with the addition that moralism is actually often a substitute for even significant ethical thinking because it is largely emotive. So to agree with the Schauberger piece to bring up a conservative theorist, it's actually had a big effect on me. And like, so you guys know, I do take conservative theory seriously. Alastair MacIntyre, who used to be a Marxist but lost faith and found faith in St. Thomas Aquinas, but that most moral theories are also highly emotive appeals because they don't try to reconcile what they're asking for at all. So one of the things that you can say is it's not even an ethical argument to say that we should have open borders and economic democracy. It is an emotional argument because we value democracy and we value human dignity or whatever. And we are emotively tied to both. We don't even try to reconcile the difficulties of those claims. Now, I actually do think there is a real way in which shutting off borders plays into a lot of the problems and actually, you know, delays class consciousness and also limits class consciousness to a national polity. But I think that's true for social democracy across the board.
Yeah, I'm not arguing for closing down the borders, or I'm not fundamentally against open borders, but I just feel like you have to have a more radical critique than the ones Nathan Robinson puts forward in order to really get at how to do that.
I'm just trying to say the quiet part's loud, Doug. We've been giving social Democrats way too much of a pass for way too long.
Yeah, okay. I agree. This is one of the major problems with Malcolm's piece, is that it does remain well within the realm of what I guess as a zero books person I will call capitalist realism, or we might call social democracy, which you're not. Social democracy is just one version of capitalist realism.
I want to get to the major claim that we haven't dealt with, and then we have to deal with another super chat. The left may prefer to talk about, I'm reading Swayuna now. The left may prefer to talk about supposed precaritization. It's not supposed, Malcolm, of the college educated. And the right may more be comfortable talking about useless college degrees, but neither side denies the fact that on this ground, there for some time now, the West has been using massive expansion of higher education, creating new class of functionaries, knowledge workers, and would-be managers, in a number in far excess of which the labor market can or could absorb. And it is only now that we are seeing with clear eyes that this class of people, which again, nobody knows the existence of, might be acting as a class. And note that
he contradicted himself. If the labor market can't absorb these people, then they're become lumpen.
Right.
They're not, and they're precarious at the very least. And it's not some great conspiracy from the American state to mismanage the production of its own working class or its own citizens. You know,
one could argue that we've been here before during the spring. I'm going to continue because you need to get all this. During the springtime of nations that swept Europe in 1848, the students of Vienna were enduring their own lost decade and were consequently far more militant revolutionary than the workers they presumed to speak for. He'd actually be talking. He's claiming to be a Marxist. He's slapping at Marx here. To be a student of Vienna back then meant graduating into a job within the imperial bureaucracy. But, and again, Swayuna keeps on appealing to late imperial, pre-capitalist imperial, and feudal politics as the model for what is going on here without justifying a switch in the economy.
Right. That's absolutely true. That's something that I didn't pick up on it as much as I should. I noted it, but I just chalked it up to a kind of rhetorical device, because talking about techno-feudalism or high-tech feudalism or, you know, return to feudalism has been such a mainstay of a certain kind of left rhetoric for so long that the fact that it's technically completely wrong hardly matters, right?
But let's get into where I think there's actually some deep reactionary politics in this that people are letting fly by. But the job market for that line of work has been dismal for some time, owing to the strained financials within the Austrian Empire. Of course, the spread of revolution through Europe in 1848 couldn't be due to French cultural imperialism alone, implying that it was partly due to French cultural imperialism that was causing the embrace of the revolutions. Note how reactionary that argument actually is for a quote Marxist unquote to say
that again,
that he partially blames French cultural imperialism for the spread of revolutionary rhetoric in the Austrian Empire.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
New ideas about constitutionalism and national relations spread most rapidly in places where conditions were right. Germany, Italy, Hungary, and fizzled out in places where they weren't, the United States and Great Britain, which we also didn't need them. We were already democratic republics. What's your problem, Swayuna? Rather than try to pine and blame on American television or even social media, it behooves us to recognize the conditions of this new springtime of managers, just as ripe in London and Berlin as they are in Portland and New York City. We now have left and right on both sides of the Atlantic as open and bitter class war. is a conflict between a growing cadre of imperial lords and the peasantry they hope to subjugate. So
that's
notice
not, these, that's not a class these, war. That's a caste system that he's.
It's a class. It's a caste war. Also, let's be clear. He's saying that the precarious managers who don't have jobs and cannot be absorbed are acting as a dominant ruling class, even though they don't have jobs and cannot be absorbed, and controlling the politics, even though they don't have jobs and cannot be absorbed. I'm just pointing out that his own claims don't make sense.
Right. That's true. Although I think what he would say is that there's a certain segment of those people do land jobs in elite institutions like the New York Times.
Well, they do. Yeah. But they
and then he goes on to say, and they use wokeness in order to secure and hold on to their power position in a highly competitive market of where there's many people just like them clamoring at the gates.
So here's the thing. With something like this, there are a bunch of things he's saying that are true, crossing some essential frameworks that are utterly false. We need to get Nico's...
Let's get this up here. Chat. And then we need to get to the parrot room pretty soon. Why did Marxists abandon the theological aspect of Marx, rate of profit falling, consolidation, socialization, and say state-solved contradictions? Well, a couple reasons. One was because we kept coming out of the Depression without the working class having that final revolution.
I was about to say, like, the teleological aspect kept on being delayed. So when one of the reasons why, to slightly defend the Frankfurt School, even though I was shitting on them earlier, one of the reasons why they thought the proletariat may not be the answer anymore is because they could not explain why you've had three different major crises between 1890 and 1931 in Germany, and none of them had successfully produced a revolution, although one of them came close, but divisions amongst the Marxists themselves ended up to things being crushed. I mean, like that. So there's a lot going on here. So to get to Kenyatta's claim, Kenyatta basically says that the knowledge economy equals managers, which is not true. He then says that, you know, the cost for free college and stuff has 2/3 of the population in the United States pay for 1/3 of the population's education, which is all elite. And again, not true if you break it down by age group. One of these things I've learned about a lot of these people is they know how to bring up basic facts, but then use them in misleading ways. So if you're under 35, your likelihood of having to go to college to get a job that used to not require a college degree has gone up dramatically, and most people under 35 have some college education and some college debt, about 60% of them. So when you look at the larger population, people in the baby boom generation and earlier who got jobs that you now require a college degree to get, yes, of course, they are A, there's a lot of old people in the United States, and B, and generationally speaking, they're well off, and B, they had much lower rates of college degrees because the credentialing didn't spread downward. So what has happened is we are now pretending that this new cadre of knowledge workers is because we've been overtraining them because we have a bunch of working class jobs and the traditional male worker who can go to the factory and do. I'm sorry that even if you read Shordran, they've been mostly automated for three decades.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, if the fact is that when I was in my 20s, which was oh so many years ago, it was already the case that there were major cultural critiques being put out that defined our generation, my generation, exactly on the topic of how you had overeducated people who were underemployed and who couldn't find work within their fields, and that even becoming a barista seemed to require a college degree or at least a very good resume. And that was the whole thing about McJobs in the book Generation X. So this is not new either. It's just intensified. And Nico points out something very important, which is that, you know, after 2008, a lot of people funneled into the university in order to escape their prospects in the job market as just uneducated workers, but also just for the freaking financial aid.
Well, I mean, let me talk about as a person who comes from the working class, and I can say this, like, I'm going to pull my working class cred stick for a second. My father is a mechanic. My mother was a waitress who became a nurse in her 40s and didn't stay a nurse. And I want to bring this up because it's exactly what you're talking about. My parents told me there were no jobs for me if I didn't go to college, that everything they saw was that if I went and like became a mechanic, which I'm not inclined to do anyway, my father knew me, but like, if I became a mechanic, that there were not enough jobs, and the jobs that did exist were low paying compared to entering the field in the early 80s. They told me that, like, verbatim. And, you know, the trades, there's a big push in 2007, 2008, you remember Mike Rowe and all that, to push people into the trades. Well, the trades are not recession resistant. One of the things we noticed is in 2008, 2009, a lot of people who went into the trades lost their jobs just with all those new college graduates who also lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. And then now they lost their jobs again. However, this time, the first time it hit men primarily, this time because of the change in the nature of what's causing the recession, it's disproportionately hit women. And because honestly, care work is more virulent. If it's not absolutely necessary right now, it's been reduced, and people are less likely to hire people who have to stay home with children. And so we haven't dealt with that. But like, I bring that up because when we talk about this as if there are all these jobs and people there's been an overproduction of elite by the state. This is a conspiracy theory. There's been an overproduction of elite driven by the fact profit margins and automation have declined working class jobs of the class variety in general.
That's not an elite. That's not an overproduction of elite. That's an overproduction of educated workers.
It's an overproduction. People. It's what it is, actually, and Turch is clear about this, is an overproduction of potential elites who are now in high competition with each other. And that's true. But that is not the same thing as one managerial elite, which all these college graduates somehow train to be. But like, you think most people who are graduating from colleges are training to be management?
No.
Look at the stats. Absolutely not. That is misleading. This is why I've had an issue with this PMC shit for a long time. And it goes back to Barbara Ehrenreich. When you're talking about managers and you're talking about professionals, you're talking largely about two different things. Pretending that they have the same interest is insane.
So like a nurse is a professional. Not all nurses are in management.
Right.
Right. And you take a whole lot of education to become a nurse.
And the professionalization of certain things has been a problem, not just with nursing.
It's a problem, but also a boon for the nurses.
It's a boon for the nursing, but it also, to bring up some of the people who are pro Soyuna and the Bellows in here, they're right, for example, that the professionalization of the unions actually pitted unions against workers, and that has become super clear, even in, quote, PMC unions, like teachers' unions, in the current health crisis.
Look, we need to, in the parrot room in about 10-15 minutes for the patrons, talk a little bit more charitably, not about the Bellows per se, or certainly not about Malcolm, but about the appeal that this sort of publication might have for a good section of the left. Why is it that the Bellows and which, by the way, we just pulled two essays, both of which have some conservative aspects. Neither of them are entirely wrong. Why is it that this has an appeal to the left? And then the other thing I want to talk about in the parrot room is, how should we handle publications that include leftists, or that might try to brand themselves as part of a Marxist even critique, when they aren't? And what... Because I feel as though there's a couple of different reactions to it, and one of them, the primary first one to become very alarmed about entryism and being infiltrated and all of that is counterproductive. But I'm not quite sure about what the proper response should be. So why don't we talk about that in the parrot room in just a bit?
All right.
All right.
But also, I am going to bring up all the stuff you had me shut up about the actual ties.
Yeah, the money. That, and one of the things that we'll talk about also is that, because it's in the Malcolm's piece as well, is that the way that different projects get tied to institutional money, whether it's on the right or the left, needs to be understood for what it is. And like,
yeah, I mean,
I'll say that, like, I know people on the left who you would never suspect had Soros money, who through a roundabout way have Soros money. Right. But they're not, but so what is that? Why is that the case? What does that reflect?
It's called the NGO industrial complex.
Exactly.
I mean, like, and I mean, to be, you know, I think Soros is the great distraction because, you know, you can get tied up and, but there's all kinds of this. There's Bill and Melinda Gates money. I bring up the example because it isn't tied to any anti-Semitic conspiracy. Private prison money in various regional ACLUs. There's a big reason for this, and the Patreon left, let's be honest, okay, and including ourselves, because we at least have the honesty of being a business. So we're not selling you anything about what Zero is outside of our opinions right now. The Patreon left often has a lot of strong, like, people's Patreons don't blow up overnight off of 1,000 small donors when you never heard of them before. Those are called crypto investors that are inflating the Patreon to attract more people to it, so the investors can actually reduce their, you know, they get payback on their investment as people. Like, it's a very smart thing. I've seen even smallish publications pull this off.
Just like throwing money into your tip jar.
Right. It's
before, the customers show up.
Except sometimes it's to the tune of like $1,000 a month. But yes. That puts you up the Patreon rankings, and then you can reduce it. But you have to have backers to do that. And I learned as a person who accidentally inherited a magazine, and I'm not going to say who and what, but who had several rich patrons that even as the editor, I didn't know about until we pissed them off. So like, and this was not a high money situation, but it was definitely the case. And so there's
We got to go to the parent room for the rest of this wonderful insider gossip stuff. And I think we might have to do another pass at the bellows sometime. Although I think you did a good job, but
I feel like I could have gone on Swayuna for 4 hours.
Well, I know. We should do another one on him. But I feel like if you like the bellows, you probably weren't going to be convinced by the things we were saying. But if you go to see us in the parent room, you'll be more convinced. And that's why you should give us $5 a month. And here we go.